Welcome to Pride Politics. I'm Jeronimo Cortina, an associate professor and associate director at the Center for Mexican American and Latino and Latina Studies at the University of Houston.
And I'm Brandon Rottinghouse, a political science professor, also here at the University of Houston. Well, Jeronimo, it breaks my heart to talk about this, but this week, unspeakable tragedy unfolded here in Texas. 19 students and two adults are dead at an elementary school in Uvalde, which is about 80, 90 miles west of San Antonio. It's the third deadliest school shooting in modern U.S. history. It is basically in a series of mass shootings that have occurred in the U.S. and that continue to occur. There have been 212 this year. It marks the 27th school shooting this year. Since 2013, there have been 78 school shootings on Texas grounds, the most of any states. Now, the leading cause of death among American children is guns. Obviously, there are political implications to this, and that's what we do. But aside from all of that, it is heartbreaking and tragic to see this happen. We have kids who are this age, and to think about how this would affect a family and a community is hard to talk about.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, hand-wrenching. It's something that is unimaginable, right? It's something that, you know, you cannot think of. We talk a lot about rights, et cetera, et cetera. And in this case, obviously, comes up the Second Amendment, right? But there's also the right of children, right? The right of kids to go to school and not be afraid to be killed. I mean, it's just, think about it, right? It's insane, right? That little kids that go to elementary school or middle school or a high school, right, have to know today the drill, right? Run, hide, fight. What the hell is wrong? I mean, seriously, it's some, like, what? What's going on? I mean, there can be a fire drill, right? A water drill or a tornado drill or whatever, right? But now it's active shooter drill. That is simply insane. I just cannot comprehend that.
And it can be anywhere, even in sleepy, dusty Uvalde, Texas, right? Way out in the middle of the desert. So I remember when Sandy Hook happened that this, my thought was it would be the wake-up call that the country needed to do something about this. And it's the same. And that's part of the politics of this. So let's dig into some of that, since that's what we do, even though it's hard to do in a situation like this. Let's start at the top. Let's start in D.C. Joe Biden came out and asked rhetorically, where in God's name is our backbone? Effectively jiding Republicans for not doing much on this. But to be honest, Democrats haven't done much about this either. They've been in charge of this for 2 years, and they've spent very little time discussing the issue. So certainly the blame goes around a little bit, but it's certainly resistance from Republicans that's been the biggest issue here. The House passed a background check bill last year. It hasn't moved anywhere in the Senate, in part because of some of the dynamics we've been talking about for weeks and years. I don't know if anything's going to move here. Obviously, conventional wisdom is that if things didn't move after Sandy Hook, where you had 20 young kids and half a dozen teachers killed, that you're not going to see much movement now. Getting a 10-vote Republican advantage is going to be hard to break the filibuster, and I don't see any movement to weaken the filibuster for gun control bill. So it's unclear where that will go. Legislatively, there are some things that they might do. They might be able to expand the background check laws. They might be able to increase the age of purchase of assault weapons, maybe tighten red flag laws, but it's going to be a challenge, right?
Well, I mean, it's going to be a challenge, but I mean, I think that, you know, after what we saw in Sandy Hook in 2012 and then in Parkland in 2018, and especially the fact that students were deeply involved in 2018, right, in order to highlight the problem, right, and having their point of views heard quite open and quite honestly, and has not changed anything again. And the fact is that most of Americans, around 52% of Americans, think, right, that they should have, or we should have, stricter gun laws. And that has come down 78% back in 1990 to 52%. And only 11% say that laws should be less strict. So once again, there is a disconnection between elected officials, the public, right? And obviously you have a very important player that is going to be the lobbies, the lobbyists, right? So who's moving the agenda? What is driving these, you know, irrational behavior of not having, you know, universal background checks? It's not that you're not going to be allowed to buy a purchase a firearm, right?
Right.
It's just that you need, or the government needs, so someone needs to know if you can handle a firearm, if you are in the right set of mind. Like, you know, and here in the state of Texas, right? You want to drive, and this is, you know, all around the world. You want to drive, you need a driver's license, right?
Right.
You need to show, right, to the DPS officer that you can operate a motor vehicle, that you can park, that you know how to stop, that you know the laws of the road, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
You want to be a hairdresser. You want to be a barber. You need a license, right?
Yeah.
You need a license. It's easier if you are 18 years of age to go and buy a gun, a firearm, than to become a barber. Because to become a barber, you have to go through school.
There's a test.
There is a test. You see what I'm saying? Yeah. I mean, it's absurd. Yeah. It's completely absurd.
Well, for sure. But and politically, I mean, I think explaining why that's the case, it's partly because, you know, the Senate is primarily made up of rural people, right? Like you've got the imbalance in terms of urban rural states, so that the rural states still have this significant amount of power as much as big urban states. And so in terms of public opinion, the rural areas are getting the kind of representation that some of the urban areas are not. So that imbalance is just something that's structurally hard to overcome. And that's why you're not seeing much movement in the Senate, but you see movement in the House. But you're exactly right that polling on guns suggests that there's a significant amount of support for this. In fact, Politico Morning Consult polls that were taken right after the shooting show that there's a net 80% approval for background checks, a net 60% approval for a national database on gun sales, a 40% approval plus approval for banning assault weapons. So there's a lot of support out there for this. And so I do feel like that there's some momentum. One problem, though, is the Senate's going on vacation. There's a Memorial Day break. And so they're all going to go back to their districts. And I think they're going to get an earful, honestly, from their constituents, at least those that do town halls, because this is something that's really pertinent. But let's switch to Texas, because Texas obviously has been, frankly, a leader in reducing the loopholes to try to own guns. They pass very quickly, like grass through a steer. 1 year ago, the legislature voted to remove the last major gun restriction in Texas, and that's basically having a license, like you said, to be able to have a firearm. So this is certainly moving in a different direction than public opinion. Explain that.
I cannot explain it, but only
that's our job.
Well, I think that it's only the fact that state legislators, our political leadership in the state, are pushing this legislation. And once again, there is this disconnection. And frankly, I guess that people or these politicians are not being made accountable to public opinion in the sense of having these background checks or having red flag laws or whatnot. And when we did our poll after the shooting in the massacre and in El Paso, right? 50-60% of survey participants agreed that in the state of Texas, once again, we should have stricter gun laws and we should have stricter, you know, or approve or support red flag laws. So once again, it's not curtailing your Second Amendment rights, right? It's only, right, making sure that whomever purchases a firearm can operate a firearm in a safe way, and that is not going to do what they did.
You make a really good point, because it's about controlling the narrative. And so I want to get into the press conference. I guess you'd say a joint press conference between Greg Abbott and Beto O'Rourke, almost, because controlling the narrative is key here. But I want to talk about what the ledge did and didn't do. So one thing that they did do, as you said, in the wake of the tragedy in El Paso, but also in the tragedy of Sutherland Springs and Santa Fe and Odessa, And that's off the top of my head. The legislative session that preceded the last of those, they put together a series of things to try to harden schools. Now, you've heard a lot about, like, trying to, you know, kind of reduce the number of entrances and exits for schools. And that's kind of what at least the mainstream narrative has been for Republicans. And they sort of did that. They, for schools, increased active shooter training. They spent more money on mental health screening. They allowed for there to be more school marshals. So they did do some things to it, but that's not a gun issue. That's a school safety issue, right? And so that's not going to solve all of these gun problems, right? Some of the things that they rejected doing were, for instance, not requiring mandatory reporting for lost or stolen guns. They didn't expand red flag laws, like you said. They didn't modify existing storage law bills. So they discarded a bunch of these or they died in committees. The governor's basically shrugged off any additional efforts to toughen these laws. So politically, I don't know that you're going to see much movement. And the fact that there's not a legislative session obviously precludes the ability to do this unless the governor calls a legislative session, which obviously he's not going to. So it's hard to have this conversation in an election year, right? I mean, 62% of Republican voters strongly approve of the job lawmakers did on gun violence after the 2021 session. So they've got a tin ear on this, even despite the fact that there's significant consensus for this. So as you said, our poll should show that there was significant support among Latinos for background checks, red flag laws, banning assault weapons. But looking at the data, it's also true in suburbs where Democrats seem to do well, and among female voters where Democrats seem to do well. So, I mean, we talked a couple of weeks ago about the abortion issue as a possible crossover issue for these constituencies that Democrats need to win. But this issue, too, is on that platform. So, you know, this is certainly something that Republicans are going to be worried about. And although it's the case that they've been pretty, you know, firm in their non-movement on this, it's certainly the case that this is going to be a big issue for the campaign, because you had a Beto Interruptus at Greg Abbott's press conference out there, and he confronted the governor saying directly, this is on you.
Absolutely.
They pushed back saying, you know, you're using this as a political stunt, but, you know, what politics is not a stunt?
Right.
So what do you make of that interaction?
Well, I mean, I think that, I don't know if it was the right time, the right moment or whatnot, but I think that O'Rourke is voicing some of the frustration, especially amongst, you know, wide net of the electorate that want to see change. And the fact that O'Rourke pointed at Governor Abbott saying this is on you is because Governor Abbott, you know, a year ago tweeted that it was time for to make Texas a Second Amendment sanctuary state. That is a fact. He said that.
Yeah.
And
years before tweeted he was mad that California was number one in gun sales and Texas was number two. Right.
Right.
These tweets don't go away. Right.
Exactly.
They're used again and again and again.
And the fact is, you know, it's deflecting, you know, responsibility. In the press conference, Governor Abbott, you know, rightly so, said, well,
yes,
Chicago has more deaths than we have over the weekend, so on and so forth, et cetera. But this is not a race and see who has more or less deaths, right? That's the wrong competition that we should have in, right?
Yeah.
It's about being a responsible gun owner, and it's about a responsible government that keeps society safe, allowing and not giving guns, right, to people that should not have access to a firearm.
Yeah.
It's very simple.
Yeah. I totally agree. And actually, I think your point is good. And the bigger point that you're making is also good. And that is that the governor trying to control the narrative on this. And so I think, and although I agree with you that it's hard to inject politics into such a tense and horrible situation, but the likelihood of there being an interaction between the two participants for the race for governor is very low. I don't think Governor Abbott will debate. And so I think O'Rourke calculated that this is the one chance you've got to be able just to throw it in his face and let's have a real discussion about this, or at least a shouting match about it, which is frankly all most debates are now anyway. So it let O'Rourke jump in there. But I think that the governor desperately needs to control a potentially volatile political situation. It's just like the winter storm, right? He was front and center and all that stuff, but he was not, for instance, during like the Santa Fe shooting and during Sutherland Springs, right? So he wants to be in the middle of this because, like a summer hurricane, it's unpredictable and dangerous. If he doesn't control that narrative, then it could definitely be something that gets out of hand for him. And that's one advantage of Republican incumbents, is that they've got the microphone, right? And Democrats are always struggling to keep up. So what O'Rourke did effectively was to inject himself into it. And they need it, right? I mean, he's got to inject some life into this campaign and take the sting out of the, heck yes, we're coming for your AR-15. So I think it did a couple of things to politically help him. Obviously, it's going to help him raise money. Obviously, the base loves it. Republicans hate it because they hate O'Rourke, right? They're like, oh, you're, you know, making this all about yourself, which he sort of was. But isn't that what politics is nowadays? And it's not like politicians don't politicize everything anyway. So I guess I'm not that worried about it. And if the, you know, people are see it as a stunt, then that's just the way it is, because frankly, in politics, everything's a stunt, right? So it does, I think, certainly move the needle on this issue. But in terms of what Greg Abbott's up to, there's still, as of our recording on Thursday morning, a question about whether or not he'll attend the NRA convention, which is happening in Houston. So what do you make of the politics of that? And obviously the Trump's coming and you're going to have a bunch of Republican notables like Ted Cruz there.
This is the issue, right? I mean, this is the issue. The NRA has been lobbying, right?
Yeah.
For less stricter gun laws, right? Over and over and over. They give a ton of money to politicians. They have their scorecard, et cetera, et cetera.
Mostly to Ted Cruz, too.
Exactly, right? Are you going to be part of that or not? I mean, they have to make a decision, and that then that decision, you know, they have to be accountable, right? It's not like, oh, yeah, but this is different. No, 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 no. It's the same thing, right? And you cannot deflect the issue to mental health. I mean, yes, obviously, both are highly correlated, right? But the issue, as you said before, is not about school safety. It's not about mental health. It's not about this or that or whatever. It's about gun control.
Yeah, and it's not core,
at the core. And it's not control like, you know, controlling in a negative sense, right? It's just making sure once again that people that have access to a firearm have the right mental capacity and have the right training. I don't want to see someone on the street with a gun, right, with a firearm that doesn't know how to use it. I mean, that's super dangerous, right?
Yes, extremely. Yeah, and I think you're exactly right on the mental health issue, because that's been sort of the narrative in the past. Not as much this time, but, you know, obviously some of these details are still unfolding. And I think the retort from the Democrats is, well, then let's get some money for mental health. And that's not forthcoming either. In fact, it's actually the opposite. So that's been a point of contention, too. So, again, I do think that there are ways here that there are solutions. I mean, I think that there are some things that both sides can agree on, but it's going to be a real challenge in an election year to get there. And frankly, probably any effort's going to have to happen at the federal level where you can get kind of cooler heads prevailing. So we'll keep a close eye on that, because this is not going to go away. And it shouldn't go away, because it's critical and it touches all of us, whether it's, you know, your parents or, you know, whether you're not, and you know, whether you know people from West Texas or not. This is something that's in all of us. And so it's important to keep that conversation alive. And before we get to the point where we can fight this out politically, we have to have a finality to the primaries. And so the rest of what we'll talk about today are the runoffs for these. We had about 1.4 million Texans vote, which is really good, actually. I was surprised it was that high. Republican voters outnumber Democratic voters about 2-1. The Democratic races weren't quite as prominent as the Republican races. So I guess that's the explanation. But it also shows you the built-in advantage that Republicans have. Let's talk about the top of the ticket first. For the lieutenant governor's race on the Democratic side, Mike Collier defeated Representative Michelle Beckley, who's a liberal member from North Texas, by a pretty healthy sum, setting up a rematch with Dan Patrick. What do you make of the chances there for Mike Collier versus Dan Patrick?
I mean, I think his chances are better than what happened before. I mean, in terms 18. Of name, in name recognition, correct?
Right. This is his third shot at a statewide office. Right?
Exactly. Yeah. So name recognition, you have said this before, Professor Rodinghouse, is that, you know, Democrats need to keep running, right? And running and running and running. It's a process. It's not a one-mile race. It's a, you know, whatever, a 100-mile race or whatever it is. So you keep trying and trying and trying and trying. So I think that that may be something that might help him. But obviously, he's going to have, I mean, all these issues, abortion, now gun control, are going to play a very important role.
Yeah. the dynamics are changed. And one thing, though, that's the same is that as it was in 18, it's really, to me, all about Beto. If Beto does well, then everybody on the Democratic ticket does well. Whether they win or not is a different story. You know, there's a lot of vagaries there. But for sure, it's all about Beto. So I think that Collier will give Patrick a pretty good run. But there's a serious money imbalance, and that's going to be something that they're going to have to figure out. Another money imbalance is in the attorney general's race. But the really interesting part of this was that you had George P. Bush, the legacy of the Bush family, losing badly to Ken Paxton, the incumbent attorney general who has fought indictments and is under federal investigation. Ken Paxton fought authority, and Ken Paxton always wins. Apologies to John Mellencamp, or as you know him, John Cougar Mellencamp. It seems like Republican voters have basically bargained that General Paxton's legal problems aren't as much of a liability as perceptions that George P. Bush is an ideological squish, right? Somebody who's not to be trusted. So that's an interesting kind of dynamic here. I think Bush tried to outflank Paxton, and no one has successfully done that. That's way too tough of a lift, even for a Bush whose political instincts are usually pretty good. So
right.
I thought that was probably a mistake. And does the constituency's never really developed other than just, you know, we don't like Paxton. The campaign never had an identity. And so although Bush was throwing heat, certainly bringing the fire in terms of trying to say Paxton had legal problems, that's going to be a liability in the fall, you know, he wasn't hitting the strike zone.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, now the bigger question is if the Bush legacy is done, is over.
Yeah.
I mean, if this was the last salvo from, politically speaking, from the Bush dynasty, what do you think about that?
That's a good question. I mean, the arc of politics is long, so it's hard to know what'll happen in the next generation. It could be that there's room for a new generation of kinder, gentler Bushes in 20 years. I don't know, but it's certainly possible. But to me, I think that George P. Bush was heir to the Bush name, but not the spirit, right? He really changed that dynamic. George H.W. Bush made the Republican Party in his image. Texas was a backwater politically. It was a totally arch conservative place, like governed by people who hated communism and, you know, thought Marxism was like the, you know, like an atom bomb. And he changed that. And George P. Bush didn't. George P. Bush leaned into that, those instincts in the Republican Party. So I'm not sure he was the real heir apparent to the Bush legacy. But I actually want to ask you a question, too. And that is that you had basically in this race two prominent Latino Republicans go down, the two biggest vote getters, 16 and 18. Eva Guzman and George P. Bush both go down.
Yeah.
What does that say about the Republican Party's acceptance of or embrace of Latino candidates?
I don't know, because, I mean, it's a mixed message. In the past, or this primary cycle, you saw a lot of Latinos running, right? Women on the Republican side, in some cases in greater quantities than Democrats. So the question is, you know, those races were obviously from very prominent, you know, attorney general to precinct chairs and whatnot, and everything in between. But we did not see significant support. And what I think is that, you know, the Republican Party is trying to get ahead of this trend, because I think that they realize that the state of Texas is going to be eventually, right, a state in which Latinos are going to be the majority of the population. So the question is how electable they are in terms of the core constituency of the Republican Party. And if the Republican Party wants to, you know, move forward, right, they have to do these very important inroads within, especially the Latino community, so they can extend their shelf life eventually in terms of the electoral futures of the party.
That's a great point. Yeah. Well, one place where the Latino vote is really prominent is in the Democratic side of things. And so looking at the Democratic side, the flip side of that, the attorney general's race, you had a Rochelle Garza matchup with Joe Jaworski, the former mayor of Galveston, and Garza beat him pretty handily.
Yeah.
The demographics really favored her because it tends to be in the Democratic side, a younger, more ethnically and racially diverse and overwhelmingly female. So that she won is not that surprising. I think it's interesting, though, to see the matchup to come right in the fall where this is something both sides wanted. You've got a conservative Anglo in Ken Paxton versus a progressive Latina. This is the future of Texas, like you said. Right?
Yep.
It's to the point where, you know, Republicans are looking for a way to be able to draw these sharp contrasts, and Democrats are too. So that's exactly what both sides got. So it's interesting to see that play out. So what do you make of that dynamic?
Well, it's going to be very interesting, right? It's going to be very interesting because what we know from other, or at least from this election cycle, is that the Democratic Party is turning itself a little bit more to the progressive side. And you know, more traditional, more conservative, more mid-center Democrats are losing ground. And also, you know, these, I guess, the new demographics of the electorate. Remember that in Texas, we have hundreds of thousands of new voters, that this is going to be the first election in which they're going to participate. Mm-hmm. And they're younger, more diverse, right? And
yes,
if everything points to the right direction, that means that they tend to be a little bit more progressive. And they want to see more progressive candidates. So it's going to be interesting to see these, you know, match up between Paxton, but also how Rochelle Mercedes Garza is going to portray herself and how she's going to move the base to support her.
It might be the race where abortion was a big issue, and it might be the only one, frankly. Like, it helped her, but didn't help, for instance, Sandra Grace Martinez or Stapleton Barrera down in in one of the Senate districts, Senate District 27. So I thought that was really interesting that it didn't play as prominent a factor as we kind of suspected it would. But one place where progressive politics was not really accepted was in South Texas. You had LaMontia over Stapleton Barrera, like I just said, in Senate District 27. You had Cuellar over Cisneros holding strong in 177 votes. Obviously, there'll be more of a recount there. And CD15 is too close to call. Michelle Viejo has a 23-point lead over more moderate to conservative Ruben Ramirez. So progressive politics didn't exactly get a lot of love in South Texas. So I think that's of interest.
But, I mean, kind of. No, I mean, if you look, for example, at the congressional district at 28, Cisneros versus Cuellar, right? South Texas or South Texas has been, you know, traditionally a very conservative community, right?
Mm-hmm.
The fact that you're seeing basically 50-50, right, to me says a lot. More than
that's a good
they
point.
Couldn't win or anything like that. It is that now it's 50-50. Before you had 80-20, 90-10. And now it's head-to-head. So that, to me, is a very, very, very important change.
That's a good point. And actually, if you look at the House candidates, you've got the first Black lesbian, the first Muslim, two out gay Black men, one of whom is HIV positive, who are going to probably go to the ledge. So the demographics are definitely changing.
Yeah,
the GOP is set to double the number of women. So there's a lot more diversity, I think, happening, especially down ballot. So we'll keep an eye on this because obviously there's lots to change. And so there's much to go in the future. And we're going to take a little break, obviously. Summer's here, and so we'll see you all in the fall because obviously there's going to be a lot more to talk about.
Absolutely. And don't forget to write us an email or shoot us a tweet or whatnot. We would be interested in knowing what you think about the podcast. You can go to HoustonPublicMedia.org and just look for the podcast right there and shoot us an email.
And while you're there, notice what a great job HPM does with all of their shows, especially with this show. So big thanks to Troy Schultz for making this a great season for us.
Yes, thank you very much, Troy. You have been a champion and very patient with all our technical difficulties. So thank you very much. I'm Jeronimo Cortina.
And I'm Brandon Rottinghouse. We'll see you next time.